On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Hockenberry, and this is On Point. You've got your Lexus. You've got your olive tree. The world is flat. A tsunami of globalization is going to remake the world. You are all ready for the 21st century, right? Thinkers from Tom Friedman to Milton Friedman say open markets and economic relationships are the key to global stability. Yet participation in the global economy didn't seem to restrain the warring Israelis and Lebanese. What gives? The evangelical Western mission to bring economic prosperity and democracy to the Middle East seems to be having trouble recruiting converts. The more things change in the world, the more they seem to stay the same in the Middle East. This hour on Point, globalization, bad idea in the cradle of civilization. Joining me now from Irvine, California is Mark Levine. He is professor of modern Middle Eastern history, culture, and Islamic studies at the University of California, Irvine, and also author of Why They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil. Professor Levine, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, what is it that didn't restrain economic success stories of Lebanon and Israel over the past decade? The fact that they both participated in the global economy to one degree or another certainly didn't keep them from coming to blows in the last few weeks. What might have happened, what should have happened to prevent what did happen?
Well, at its most basic level, what happened was that the gains from globalization were concentrated among certain classes of both societies. And we need to also include Palestinians in the equation. It's very easy to forget that there was still a war going on, especially in Gaza during this time. And it's really the three countries together, the three societies together, that make this so interesting and also so tragic. You had this idea going back to the early 90s of a new Middle East that was Shimon Peres's baby and was supposed to help make Israel the cultural and economic engine of a newly globalized region where prosperity would reach across to everyone. The problem is, like in so much of the developing world, especially Latin America and Africa and even parts of Asia, including a large share of the Chinese and Indian economies, the gains were concentrated among those who either already were wealthy or among a newly rising bourgeoisie, so to speak, that left out millions and millions of people from these benefits and these gains. And what you saw in Lebanon, what you saw in the occupied territories, what you saw in Israel were those people who were left out turning to the groups that spoke to the fact that they were left out, that spoke to the fact that this new Middle East, that if you go to Beirut, as I do often, that was exemplified by the rising downtown and the skyscrapers and the fancy hotels, well, that left out southern Beirut and much of southern Lebanon. If you go to Israel, where, you know, the what many Israelis call Yuppistan in Tel Aviv, you had people who were benefiting from the stock market and the high-tech companies, but a large share of the population in Israel, both Jews, especially Middle Eastern Jews, and Palestinian citizens, were not benefiting from this globalization of the Israeli economy. And so when you had the conflict with Palestinians continuing, you had the occupation deepening, you had and most of the gains not really translating to at least a million or more people within the economy. You had poverty increasing, you had inequality increasing. This allowed the religious and nationalist right in all three societies to eventually, by the late 90s, take a lot more power. And that set the stage for the conflict today.
So if we're talking about Hezbollah, and let's talk about Hezbollah for a moment before we shift to Israel, mm-hmm. Do you think Hezbollah is against globalization, or are they against being left out of globalization?
Well, you can't separate that from the even more basic question, which is occupation. They arose out of the Israeli occupation, and they defined themselves and became very important because what the occupation did and the larger Lebanese civil war was pretty much destroy the Lebanese state as an effective institution. So besides being a militant group, Hezbollah had to learn how to provide all sorts of services, health services, education, all the other services that people now talk about, that the Lebanese state wasn't doing. Once the war was over and the state began to rebuild itself, Hezbollah was still providing these services because the state was concentrating so much of its efforts in rebuilding Lebanon as a tourist mecca.
Is that to say quickly that if instead of Hezbollah doing these social redevelopment projects, that USAID had done it, or the United Nations had done it, or the World Bank had done it, or these arms of traditional globalization had done it, that they would reap the political benefits that Hezbollah now has in southern Lebanon?
Well, they certainly would have, but the point is those institutions that you're talking about rarely do it, because one of the things about globalization, the way the World Bank or the IMF define it, is that the state is supposed to reduce expenditures in many of these areas. So in all countries, especially around the Middle East, which has been so marginalized, you see the Islamist movements performing these functions that the state either can't or won't do, and that's winning allegiance from the people. And that's exactly what happened in Lebanon, and why Hezbollah was popular enough to be able to take a war, a premeditated war that destroyed much of the country, and still retain the loyalty of all the citizens who were most gravely affected
by
that.
Well, not only retain it, but to create a redevelopment and rebuilding program financed by Iran, which will probably strengthen Hezbollah's standing in southern Lebanon, if not in the entire country. Let's step back from the Middle East for a moment. When people talk about globalization, what do you think they're talking about? And if the goals of globalization were actually to be reached, what kind of, you know, multinational cooperation do you think is necessary to make that happen?
Well, you're very right that before we talk about globalization in the Middle East, we need to know what we're talking about when we say the word globalization.
Hey, come on. It's easy. It's Starbucks, right? It's Starbucks in Moscow and Prague and, you know, Sao Paulo, right?
That's certainly one aspect, and that's a very important. And strangely enough, Starbucks is more of an indication of cultural globalization than economic globalization. I mean, the first thing is political globalization, world government, which, of course, is never going to happen anytime soon. The second thing is economic globalization. And here, most mainstream economists or proponents of globalization talk about it as an increasing integration of the world economy, growth in the world economy, openness of countries across the globe, both rich, middle-income and poor, to trade, to foreign investment, to financial transactions, diversification, privatization, all these big code words, liberalization of economies. The problem is when economists actually look at the data, it's not happening across the board to the extent people assume. It's being concentrated more and more in the wealthy countries. And much of that growth that is happening from things like financial integration or financial transactions that don't really affect people on the ground positively. So you know,
what's really curious to me is we have this assumption in the United States, and maybe it's not shared around the world, that if we send our movies or send our commerce or, you know, fast food, whatever sort of American brands end up around the world internationally, that somehow there's a benign message that floats somehow out of the Big Mac or off of the face of Harrison Ford about America to the people sitting and watching the movie. And in fact, it seems that nothing like that occurs at all, that the context of America does not travel with our brands. Is that what you've discovered in your travels?
Absolutely. I can give you one specific moment of traveling. I was on the train from Casablanca to Marrakesh once, and I was passing the slums outside of Casablanca. And you could see all these extremely poor people in, you know, very low-cost housing, but everyone had a satellite dish. And what this was telling me, and in speaking with lots of people, especially poor people, is that everyone can consume the images, the symbols of globalization. They can see Harrison Ford's picture. They can watch the European movie, especially pornography that comes on late at night. But they cannot buy most of the things that are being advertised, the new mattresses, the nice cars, all of these things. So if you're being sold a globalization that's almost impossible to resist, right? Because who doesn't want to live like they do on Baywatch, right? And look like everyone on Baywatch. But very few people can afford to actually buy. The level of frustration that this causes is very significant. And when you combine it with occupations that go on around the world, with authoritarian governments which depend on the U.S. and its allies to stay in power, you really have an almost perfect storm of factors that are going to lead to a lot of resentment and, in some cases, violence against the system.
What about companies like Pepsi and Coke, which don't, you know, they don't sell Baywatch bodies that might be frustrating, but just a simple, you know, drink. Does that have a more benign message? I mean, it certainly employs a lot of people.
Well, you know, Pepsi and Coke are very interesting things. Someone once told me, or someone told a colleague of mine in Mexico or in Brazil, that they thought Pepsi was invented in their country, right? Because it's always been there, as far as they could tell. And the idea that these are an American brand, some brands have become globalized enough that their roots in America or in France or wherever have been lost. And these are brands that have succeeded and are not being, you know, symbolized, don't symbolize American aggression or whatever it is that people complain
about. Well,
like
RC Cola in the Middle East. RC and Fanta are identified with the Arab world because Coke had the franchise in Israel
and
was banned.
Pepsi, too. Pepsi was identified in the Arab world. But I remember when I was in Iraq a couple of years ago, that people were, the manager of the Pepsi plant was basically in hiding, and the Pepsi plant, you know, you couldn't even find out where it was because they were so scared people were, the insurgents were going to attack it, because a brand that had symbolized, you know, putting up with the boycott and not doing business with Israel has now became a symbol of the American occupation, and people were going after it. So these, where you stand and who you symbolize can change depending on the conditions.
My guest is Mark Levine. He's professor of modern Middle Eastern history, culture, and Islamic studies at University of California, Irvine. And I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining me from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Douglas Irwin. He's a professor of economics at Dartmouth College and the author of the book Free Trade Under Fire. Welcome, Professor Irwin.
Pleasure to be here.
What do you make of what seems to be a fairly frustrating inability of economic cooperation in the Middle East to provide a kind of political glue for the region? Certainly, I don't find when I go to Saudi Arabia the fact that they've sold so much oil to the United States creating an enormous love for American culture and values.
That's certainly the case. And if you look at what's happened to per capita income across many countries in the Arab world, it's been quite dismal over the past couple decades. Between 1985 and about the year 2000, per capita income rose 30% in Israel. And it's actually declined in a lot of other countries, such as Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Iraq, Iran, and what have you. So that inequality just is not doing well for the region.
So does this argue for some massive Marshall Plan for the Middle East that would address some of these development and economic inequality issues? Or is there some kind of, you know, Milton Friedman-esque market-based jumpstart that nobody's tried yet?
Well, I think the problem that a lot of countries in the Middle East face is that they haven't really tried globalization. They're not open economies. Egypt, for example, has a trade-to-GDP ratio of about 3%, which is very small compared to, say, a country like Malaysia or Thailand, where it's about 15%. These countries, it's amazing the number of Middle Eastern countries that are not a member of the World Trade Organization. It's not as though being a member of the WTO is inherently good, but it's an indication that they just are not engaged in the world economy. They don't really want to become part of it.
Is that your impression, Mark Levine, I mean, in your travels, that there's a kind of enforced disengagement, both culturally and politically?
No, actually. I think the main problem with this kind of discourse, and we see this in the World Bank and IMF writings about the Middle East and about globalization, is this idea that the region is not globalized because somehow it's the fault of the leaders itself or some kind of willing disengagement with the world economy. We have to remember the Middle East was one of the first globalized regions in the world. In fact, it had among the highest growth rates in the period before the period that was just mentioned, which is 1965 to 85, precisely because it was going through a kind of nationalist-led development strategies, or what scholars call an authoritarian bargain, which allowed these states to provide and to invest in the social and economic development of the country, which once the region became slowly integrated into the world economy and structural adjustment programs came in, changed these levels of growth, made them negative, rose inequality somewhat, rose poverty somewhat. And it's been left in this very strange catch-22, which is that if the region wants to maintain its position as perhaps the region with the lowest poverty and lowest inequality in the world, it can only do so by remaining somewhat separate from the kind of inequality and poverty levels that have increased as growth has increased in many countries, especially in Latin America and other regions that are supposedly models for the Middle East to follow.
Professor Irwin, would you equate, as I suspect, and I don't want to mischaracterize Mark Levine's idea here, But would you equate the authoritarian development model in the Mideast during the period of the 60s through the 80s with something like the Singapore model or the successes of the Asian tigers?
Not really, because they were much more inwardly oriented development. They wanted to pursue an import substitution strategy, whereas the East Asian tigers pursued an export-oriented strategy, where they really wanted to conquer world markets, focus on producing quality goods for the world market, rather than big investment projects, big dams, big steel factories and what have you, just for the domestic market.
Well, except, I mean, oil is kind of an export.
Oh, it is, of course. But it's very difficult. You know, natural resources do not guarantee riches for a country. I mean, Hong Kong is just this rock, this island. Japan has no natural resources. In some sense, many economists have pointed out that natural resources can be a curse. Precisely because that becomes a lever of riches domestically, and you get internal turmoil over fighting over the spoils. Whereas when you don't have that, when you only have labor, you really have to work on increasing domestic productivity and selling to the world.
Mark Levine, you really talk about how the oil economy has crippled the Middle East's economic outlook, both internally and externally. Would you say it's for the same reasons as Professor Irwin here?
Yeah, well, what we have to realize is that there's more than one globalization going on. And to even make generalizations such as the Middle East, which is such a large area, when you realize some are blessed or cursed with all this oil, some have very few natural resources or mostly natural resources and not the development of industry, it's almost wrong to try to generalize between a country like Egypt or even Sudan before it discovered oil and a country like Saudi Arabia. But the problem is that the region is already part of the global economy. It's just part of a different global economy than the one we imagine globalization to be. The oil, arms transfers, a kind of structural marginalization of the Middle Eastern economy outside of the formal flows of capital and all the investments that have allowed regions like East Asia to grow so well. This is part of the system that Middle Easterners are caught in, and they understand that, which is why most people I speak to say, you know, globalization would be a great thing if we could have it. But our governments don't want it. The U.S. doesn't want us to have it. The financial institutions of the IMF or the World Bank don't want us to have it. So the only networks we have are our own alternative networks, which are the networks of Hezbollah or the networks of other Islamist movements, which don't participate in these formal networks and therefore can move money and funds and goods much more efficiently to their people than the formal networks can. Unfortunately, they also can move money for terrorism and other things much more efficiently than the formal networks. So this is the result of this kind of catch-22 of a system that doesn't benefit hundreds of millions of people in the region.
I'm speaking with Mark Levine, professor of modern Middle Eastern history, culture, and Islamic studies at the University of California, Irvine, and Professor Douglas Irwin, professor of economics at Dartmouth College, author of Free Trade Under Fire. Douglas Irwin, how might the governments of the Middle East join the global economy in a way that you think would benefit them, that would involve less emphasis on natural resources, more emphasis on exports, a better relationship with the globalization institutions like the World Bank, and something to counter the success of Hezbollah?
Well, if you look at the United Nations Development Program, they've done some very interesting reports on called the Arab Human Development Report over the past couple of years. And what they point out is that many societies in the region are closed, their economies are stifled, and the people are repressed. And what they found through surveys is that one out of two Arab youths is dissatisfied with the prospect of living in a closed society and has expressed a desire to emigrate. So clearly these are failing economies. They also note that these countries really don't encourage business formation, welcome foreign investment, welcome the exchange of goods across borders, or even international trade and ideas. One of the facts reported in one of the reports that Tom Frieden highlighted is that the Arab world translates about one-fifth of the number of books that Greece alone translates. And that's just an indication of how engaged and how much they want to become part of the world economy. I do think that globalization is a bit of a choice. I agree with Mark that being globalized in terms of oil, that is part of the globalization process, and it hasn't played out very well for them. But there's another part, too, that they have to be open to foreign investment. They have to think about joining the WTO and attracting foreign investment like Asian countries did. They do have great resource in terms of their people, and they just have to put them, use them to their best.
All right, Peter is from Leicester, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
How you doing? My question is there going to come a time when U.S. or multinational corporations are going to begin to pressure the U.S. government to have more enlightened policies to get more people in the economic game? Is that something that is down the road?
Mark Levine?
Yeah. I think the first thing we have to talk about is who is the they we're talking about. The Professor Irwin was talking about, or the caller. If the they are the authoritarian governments of the region who benefit from the current system, and therefore the U.S. benefits from the current system because our main goal is to keep these governments in power who maintain the system that benefits us, then the question is no, because it's actually working. Right? If you look at the main beneficiaries of globalization in the Middle East, it's the arms and oil companies. I mean, just if you look at the data. And these companies have an incredible amount of power, both in our economy and with our government, and of course with governments there. So when the World Bank makes recommendations that these countries have to increase spending on education or health, it's impossible to do that if they're already spending twice or three times the world average on weapons and having to service debt and all the things that are part of the current system. So the they that has to make this kind of choice also includes us. It's a systemic issue around the world, and the world system really has to change and evolve to something much more sustainable if these countries in the region, if that they and those people are going to have the chance to actually determine their own economic fate.
Professor Irwin, do you think that there's a chance of, let me give you a business model here. And I want to take sort of what the caller was suggesting. What if a corporation went to the U.S. government or USAID and said, hey, you know, we have this really terrific portable hospital system that you can plant in any sized village or city, connect it to electricity and water, and you've got a medical clinic that can serve, you know, thousands of people. And we would love to develop a grant program, a development program, and sell these to you in Washington to then set up in places like southern Lebanon. Does that go over? Is that a plausible business model for any corporation attempting to change or influence U.S. policy?
I guess I would be skeptical about how much that would work. I think one of the reasons why there hasn't been a lot of foreign investment in certainly Lebanon and some of the other countries is that the danger of property destruction. So I'm not sure even if you got the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation involved that you could really overcome the deep political problems that the region has. And in some sense, that's a barrier to become part of the better globalization that we hope they would become part of at some point.
Well, certainly the investors, so to speak, from Iran weren't terribly concerned about having Israel bomb the construction investments they made in southern Lebanon and are happy to pony up money to reassemble it. Are the international investors like Bill and Melinda Gates and the USAID just more chicken about this stuff, more wimpy?
Well, they really have different objectives, obviously, a private business versus the aid organizations. But it's the problem is that there's no really good model in the area that others can emulate. That's what happened in East Asia, where one or two countries went on a different track. It seemed to work out, so other countries began to follow in some sense. And that sort of dynamic has not happened in that region.
And for political reasons, the Arab world isn't particularly interested in openly emulating Israel, I gather. Jason is from Boston. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi, I was just going to suggest that the globalization could be used, to benefit local economies and to alleviate poverty, and to be seen more as a vehicle for the developing nation itself to sell its goods to export, rather than foreign conglomerates to come in and take advantage of them for their own gain. And I was also going to comment that, for example, if Israel wants Hezbollah out of Lebanon, it would seem to me that what they would want to do is encourage the building of the Lebanese economy and encourage trade in order to alleviate the poverty that creates an affinity towards extremism. And I just wondered what you all thought. I'll take a response off the air.
Mark Levine.
Well, The caller raises a very important problem, which is what is globalization and what are people's interests, right? Israel's primary interest in all this is to retain the West Bank, as much of the West Bank as possible. And all these maneuvers, whether it's the war in Lebanon or everything else, eventually, as the Haaretz columnist Gideon Levy wrote, is a war about real estate. So you have, which is, and the real estate here is the Golan Heights and the West Bank. So first of all, we have to link the economic issues we're talking about to territorial conflict. Then we need to link it to all the cultural issues. And one of the things that I showed in my book, Why They Don't Hate Us, is that to the extent that globalization is bypassing the Middle East economically or marginalizing it, cultural globalization, as I mentioned before, is still very powerful. And that cultural globalization is very negative, is a very negative experience largely in the region for obvious reasons. And that makes it harder to have the kind of hospitals being dropped in saying made in America and everyone saying, oh, thank God the Americans are here to save us again. Because they understand that it comes with a whole lot of assumptions that may not benefit the people who it's intended to benefit. So again, I would say we have to look at this holistically. Yes, if we had a grassroots-based, you know, microeconomic globalization like in parts of Bangladesh with small businesses and microcredit, this would work wonders in the region. But there's very good reasons why no one in power wants that to happen, because it would take away their power, and that's the last thing anyone who runs the system wants to happen.
So external investment is dubious because of the political instability in the region, and a decentralized micro-investment is a threat to the pre-existing centralized regimes in the region. Professor Douglas Irwin, stepping back from the Middle East for a moment, a lot of people who write about globalization say the emergence of the markets and the middle classes in India and China are going to be decisive and transformative to the world. How's that going to play out, do you think?
Well, these countries have done tremendously well over the past 20 years, but when you look at how far they have to go, they're still so far behind Western countries in terms of per capita income. This is going to be a huge event over the next generation in terms of the rising income levels and whether they can maintain political stability, particularly in China, not so much an issue in India. And so I think it's the big story of our day, what's happening to these billions of people in East Asia whose living standards are rising for the first time in a couple of generations.
Mark Levine, is there room for all of this rising standard of living on the planet?
Well, this is the problem. You know, we're selling the world, and China and India especially are listening, that you can be like us. But we are 6% of the world and use 25% of the world's resources. If 40% of the world use the equivalent amount of resources, four times their demographic proportion, the world would cease to exist. All the resources would be used up. And this really brings us to something which is so crucial to talk about, which is this idea of growth, that the best way to do globalization is through endless economic growth. If China could be like us, there would be no more us, because the world literally would be burned to a cinder.
I'd like to indulge my interest in history here and welcome another voice into the conversation. Joining us from New York City is Jerry Meyer, the author of A World Undone, the story of the Great War, 1914 to 1918. Jerry, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
You know, my reading of the history of World War I was that in the months and years leading up to World War I, from the turn of the century, there was a belief in the Edwardian moment there in Europe that the new global economy, such as it was, the industrial age, had created a network of interdependence that made a world war on the scale of 1914 unimaginable and, in fact, impossible. Didn't work out that way, did it?
It certainly didn't, but you're right about what many people believed. The world of the summer of 1914, just before the so-called Great War broke out, was in fact a globalized world to an extent that probably would surprise many people today. It wasn't the same globalization that we have today. It was overtly imperial and colonial. It involved wanting to possess foreign lands and possess their raw materials. It involved very little in the way of exporting of jobs. In fact, it involved bringing raw materials back to the home country in North America or Europe and creating jobs there. But it did meet some of Professor Levine's most important criteria for globalization. There was a great deal of integration among countries and empires. There was a great deal of interdependence. There was an impulse toward openness of trade, et cetera, open economies. But nothing could be clearer than that this did not prevent the worst war in the history of humanity up to that time, a war that ruined most of these empires. That shouldn't have come as a surprise to anybody, because the decade before 1914 was a series of increasingly serious crises around the world, political, diplomatic, nearly military crises that could very easily have sparked the war before 1914.
Well, it's interesting because it really mirrors what Mark Levine is saying, in the sense that there's this romantic notion of the emergence of the world into a new world order, so to speak. Yet, when you look back at what led up to World War I, and it should be said that the reason the nations went to war in Europe was that they had treaties explicitly committing them to go to war under the circumstances that played out in 1914. Nevertheless, the war was about competition for sea lanes, for imperial commodities like coal and oil and energy and agricultural goods. The global economy was very much in play as a destabilizing force, not a stabilizing force.
There was a great deal of instability. There was a great deal of conflict between countries, between empires, and also within, you know, as the colonial powers, the globalizing powers, modernized and industrialized, that process created all kinds of conflicts within them, between the new industrial working classes and the traditional elites, etc. It was indeed very stabilizing. Again, very destabilizing. I simply can't see any way. I can't claim to be an economist or an economic historian, but I simply can't see any way in which globalization, at least in that context of 1914, contributed in any way to making the world a more peaceful place.
Well, Jerry Meyer, whether you're an economist or not, you're certainly a eloquent chronicler of a very long historical narrative, as we've learned this hour. Jerry Meyer is the author of A World Undone, The Story of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, reminding us that we've been here before. He joined us from New York City. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Wow, Mark Levine in Irvine, California. You know, history is repeating itself. What a cliche, but pretty relevant at this moment.
Well, cliches are cliches because they're true usually. And Jerry is absolutely right. I mean, the world was more globalized, in fact, up until 1914 than it is today in terms of financial integration and especially the freedom to migrate, which, of course, helped build America. But this idea that because it was an imperial era last time, it doesn't feel the same this time. In fact, if you read Muslim critics of globalization, and I've read pretty much most of the stuff they've written in most of the relevant languages, they talk about an invasion. They talk about globalization today being a new form of imperialism dressed in, you know, the same imperialism dressed in new clothes. They perceive it as a grab for land, a grab for resources. They see oil as being the root, for example, of our presence in Iraq. So much of it is replaying. And of course, we have to remember, and here's where culture is important. Every country, really, in the Muslim world, with the exception of parts of the Arabian Peninsula, was either conquered or occupied by Europe or the U.S. in the last 100 years, right? So this is the rationality, the mentality, the history that people are living with when they see a globalization come in that is very unequal, that they can't really participate in, and that seems to be tied to war and chaos and generating profits at their expense.
This is part of the brand. It's part of the brand.
That's the brand.
At this point,
yeah. And Islam, when we see now President Bush talking about Islamo-fascists or the axis of evil, all these kinds of ubiquitous, generalizing, universalizing names, people feel that that is just generalizing the entire Muslim world to allow for more war, more occupation, and more of an economy that, again, doesn't benefit them and actually hurts them when they want to be globalized.
All right, let's go to Carol from Mount Juliet, Tennessee. Carol, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I agree with the person who's speaking. Globalization in India has been absolutely horrid. Coke has been there, and they tried to privatize the water, and what ended up was the water got polluted. The poor people couldn't get any water, and without water, there is no life. Monsanto came in, and they put a patent on the Indian wheat, and then they went and did genetic engineering with it, and the poor farmers are committing suicide because the wheat won't grow, and Europeans came in and put a patent on a tree called the neem tree, which for forever the people in India have been using it for toothpaste and for disinfectant, and you can't put a patent on a tree or a plant. I mean, that's ridiculous. They took them to court, and they did win the patent on the tree, and at last I heard, at least in one small town, Coke had to give them back their water.
No, but, Carol, thank you very much. I mean, it, certainly those stories are, you know, very, very interesting, and also indicate a kind of something that Mark Levine has talked about, a kind of cultural clash where economic development clashes against cultural notions of what is a seed, what is farming, what is water, what is land ownership, all that sorts of thing. Bob from Lexington, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Yes. I think that the statement about the Arab countries being concerned about invasion of other cultures, I think is true, but they also are just as interested in invading other cultures as well by their own culture. So, you know, that should be an issue which should be a separate conversation. As far as globalization and expanding economies, I am in the business world, and it's the way people approach business and how they see trade and how they see their ability to work with other people.
Mark Levine, an aggressive Arab world?
Well, in fact, what's funny is that in places like Beirut, the most important globalizers were the Arab globalizers from the Gulf. And in Syria, Dubai, capital from Dubai and Qatar and Kuwait are buying up large swaths of the countryside around Damascus and turning them into luxury developments for the rich. And so you see globalization is happening. It's not just about us versus them. That's one of the crucial things I try to point out in my book. It's also they who are doing it to themselves. And people like it just as little when it's their quote-unquote own kind doing it to them as they do when it's quote-unquote the other side who's doing it to them. But the caller, the last caller, also made a very important point, which is, you know, even the success stories like India and China, it's very important to realize, are not as much of a success when you look at the data as we imagine them to be, as the way they're portrayed in the press. China has labor revolts daily around the country. Hundreds of millions of people have seen poverty worsen, especially in the rural parts of China, which aren't being blessed with globalization the way the urban parts. And we can go on and on. It's much more of a mixed bag, even in what we could call the Walmart of countries, China, which is so big it can actually dictate the terms of its own globalization. If China's having all this trouble, imagine a small country like Morocco or Egypt or countries that have nothing like the power of the industrial base that China has to develop on its own terms. This is what frightens people.
Scott from Somerville, Mass., you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to just contribute the notion that in East Asia and India, I really do think that they, and even the United States, are positive models for development that the Middle East might emulate. And I want to go back to the United States development itself had two main factions in terms of the development. One was sort of an agrarian model, and they were sort of afraid of globalization, and Richard Hofstadter really points this out in many of his scholarly works. But then the other side really wanted change, wanted industrialization, and I think both in the United States and in the East Asian models, there was this balancing between sort of fear and a longing for a path, but also another faction that really wanted to embrace change. And, of course, a lot of the change did come with a lot of deleterious effects like labor revolts, as Professor Levine is mentioning. But at the same time, in the long run, the change was positive. And I believe that if people look at Asia not as a monolithic region, but looked at some really outstanding leaders who looked at their populations and said, well, there is this fear and it's legitimate, but at the same time, in order to preserve our cultural traditions, to really enhance, bring people out of poverty, we must embrace this change and that there's really no alternative.
Thank you, Scott. You know, finding the courage economically to go forward into globalization despite perhaps leaving some cultural features behind or threatening them to some extent, which leads me to something you write about in your book, Mark Levine, cultural jamming. You're a guitarist, right?
Yes.
And you describe in your book these culture jams that involved people from all walks of life in the Middle East and various places that you visited, kind of getting together in something I can only describe as like a group hug meets a rave, and that you were very moved by this phenomenon and this kind of cultural mixing without an economic component to it necessarily, but you feel like maybe it's an alternative to thinking only in terms of McDonald's and Starbucks. Explain.
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, you characterize it much better than I ever did with the group hug meets rave. But for me, if globalization is primarily culture, then culture has to lead the way in creating the kind of globalized economy that would actually benefit most people and also creating a climate of peace. So when I was in Lebanon last time, a couple of months ago before the war, I was performing with a band there, The Chords, which is one of the biggest rock bands in Lebanon. We were doing a version of The Wall, Pink Floyd's The Wall, in front of a packed audience, and everyone was screaming and singing every word of The Wall. And you could tell, and I talked to the audience afterwards, you know, how symbolic the song The Wall is for them in that pre-war era when they thought they were tearing down the walls and opening up to the rest of the world.
But how does that work? I mean, you know, tonight The Chords and Professor Levine is sitting in. Whoa. And like suddenly all your groupies come from like East Beirut.
Well, actually, I didn't have enough groupies there, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view. But no, this is a scene that exists. There's actually, I mean, my new book, Heavy Metal Islam, I look at all these scenes around the world, or the Muslim world. There are huge metal scenes, punk scenes, hip-hop scenes, rock scenes. People are trying to globalize. People are very comfortable being metalheads and Muslims. You can be both. And people want to integrate as long as the people on the other side who are coming without the baggage of 200 years of imperial rule, without the baggage of corporations trying to sponsor them. And this is really the mix that's so delicate.
Metalhead and Muslims. I think, you know, that's like your album. That's your next album.
Peter. I'm doing an album, actually.
Of course you are. Of course you are. Peter's from Lexington, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
All this business about rock groups and so on, being endowed with such significance, I find absurd. Surely the main issue, whether or not one thinks globalization is good or is bad or is sometimes good or sometimes bad, is, inshallah, fatalism within Islam that says, essentially, you can get manna from heaven, that is, OPEC oil revenues, but they may come, but we don't really need, and all Arab oil states have failed to establish modern economies, even with the receipt of $10 trillion since 73.
So you're saying that some sort of cultural feature that you describe as inshallah fatalism is a restraint or an inhibitor on Arab development?
I'm saying if you get $10 trillion since 73, and you nowhere create a modern economy, this requires explanation.
All right, let's. We're running out of time here. Mark, right. Levine, go ahead.
The explanation is that they have created very modern economies. The question is, who are the economies benefiting? A huge share of that money, of course, is recycled back to the U.S., whether it's arms purchases, whether it's buying U.S. debt. So to say that all Arabs are fatalists, that's a ridiculous generalization. To say that Arabs don't have modern economies, again, is just factually untrue. And to say that, you know, cultural interpenetration is absurd is also, I think, absurd, because when I was in Morocco at the last rock festival, you could see women there in abayas, in conservative dress, with their young children who were metalheads, just like you could see mothers being dragged to metal concerts here. The problem is the fight between the average people and the artist and an economic corporatized globalization which is threatening everyone. That really is what most Muslims see as among their biggest threats in the struggle for globalization today.
Hope in the Middle East, yes, metalhead Muslims. That's a great ending, a great moment to end this discussion on. Thank you very much, Mark Levine. It's been a real privilege talking to you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking with Mark Levine, professor of modern Middle Eastern history, culture, and Islamic studies at the University of California. I'm John Hockenberry. In for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.